This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us here on Trumpet Hour. Our panel of trumpet writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Yesterday at thetrumpet.com, we launched a new feature called Trends, and this really highlights the difference between the trumpet and any other news source. Keeping up with the news can be pretty difficult. There's a lot of information out there. But amid the thousands of headlines that are continually streaming through the news, our staff has identified a few dozen critical trends that are really worth following. These are big picture items that tie together the most important headlines and make sense of what's happening. We've broken the world into four major geographic areas that we watch: the Middle East, Europe, Asia, and Anglo-America. And we've started this feature by publishing three items in each of these areas, the three important trends that you need to keep your eyes on. In Asia, for example, we're watching Russia returning to superpower status. So you can go to the Trends tab, you can click on the link under Asia that says Russia returning to superpower status, and you're going to come to a page with two elements on it. There's a timeline of past articles that we've written tracking this trend, and there's a link to a special report bringing you up to speed on the trend and helping you connect all the pieces together. So each of these reports gives an overview of the trend. It dives into relevant history and geography and culture and politics. It explains why it's so important, even if no one else thinks that it's front page news. It looks back at the forecasts that we've made about the subject and those of our predecessor, Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor of The Plain Truth. And it shows how this trend fulfills the prophecies of the Bible, and it projects where it is leading. I thought it would be worth mentioning this because today's Week in Review program is a great example of how this way of looking at the world informs this program, where we're talking about the most important headlines of the week. There isn't much in this show that you're going to get from any other news outlet that gives the big headlines of the previous week, but these are important stories, and quite a few of them connect with one another. Hopefully, we can help you to make some of these connections. Our first story today highlights that trend of Russia returning to superpower status. This is important for several reasons, and a major one of those reasons is the fact that this trend is actually helping to drive another trend that we'll talk about, Europe's ongoing unification project. You can find that on our trends page as well. We'll get to that later, but we'll start by following up with something that we've reported on, these massive Russian war games. They started yesterday in Belarus. This is the largest war games that Russia has launched since the end of the Cold War. To learn what is going on here and to talk about its prophetic significance, we're going to turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, Russia and Belarus kicked off this set of week-long, large-scale military drills and combat maneuvers. It's called Zapad 2017. And Zapad is the Russian word for West, and that's really what these drills are about. In these drills, Russia and Belarus envision a scenario in which illegal militias from Western nations are waging kind of an incursion on Belarus and Russia and crossing the borders into their nations. And in this hypothetical scenario, these illegal militias are secretly supported by unnamed powerful nations in the West who supply them with armaments and with naval and air capabilities. So in the Zapad games, the combined forces of Russia and Belarus are just kind of practicing for what they would do in order to neutralize such a threat from the West. And the hypothetical scenario that Russia envisions here is really interesting to me because it almost perfectly mirrors what Russia actually did back in 2014 when it sent lots of soldiers wearing no insignia and no uniforms into Ukraine. These were nicknamed Little Green Men. And since they were stripped of their insignia, Russia was able to deny that Moscow had anything to do with all the havoc that they were wreaking there in Ukraine. And of course, the Russian military also supplied them with all kinds of advanced weaponry, including the Buk surface-to-air missile that shot down that Malaysia Airlines civilian airliner over Ukraine that we spoke about quite a bit when that happened. So it really looks to me like an instance of psychological projection, in a sense, in which Russia is saying, we would use this tactic. In fact, we have used this tactic very successfully. So why wouldn't Europe and the United States use it against us? So anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry has been very adamant that the war games are purely defensive in nature and has said that the drill does not present any threat to anyone in the European nations. But despite all of these Russian assurances, there is still an astounding amount of concern among Europeans, especially there in the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which are very close to where most of these drills and exercises are taking place. So some Europeans fear that Zapad 2017 will sort of serve as a Trojan horse and give Russia the chance to quietly leave behind some soldiers and some military gear. Lithuania's defense minister spoke out about this a couple of days ago. He said, "We can't be totally calm. There is a large foreign army massed next to Lithuanian territory." And partly because of these fears, there are four NATO battle groups on alert right now in the Baltic nations and also in Poland, while these Russian and Belarusian drills take place. And there's also a lot of fear among Europeans that these drills could end up having far more soldiers involved than the 12,700 that Russia says are taking part. Although Russia has invited observers from more than 80 international groups like the UN and NATO and the OSCE to observe the game. So it's hard to say if they really could secretly inflate those numbers or not. But in either case, it's clear that Europe is very concerned about these drills. These drills are certainly not the only manifestation of Russian aggression that Europe has witnessed in recent years. The drills actually fit perfectly in with a pattern of increasing Russian aggression that you spoke about and just rising military power.
Well, maybe you could just contextualize that for us in some of those other areas where Russia is taking actions and doing things that are causing that kind of trepidation among Europeans.
Sure. Well, it began in 2004 when Russian President Vladimir Putin began. This was internally within Russia, but he was making a lot of moves that position him to really be a dictator of Russia for the first time. And, you know, since the Soviet Union had collapsed, he was working behind the scenes to rig the elections. And then, of course, he ended up installing a puppet in 2008, Dmitry Medvedev. And so he's essentially positioned himself as a dictator or a tyrant. He's been in power now for 17 years and looks like he could easily stay in until he dies, the way he has the system rigged at this point. So that's within Russia, and that's been very alarming to Europeans to see a new tyrant rise up right on the other side of their borders there.
And very canny and capable tyrant.
Yes, that's right. And then in 2008, Russia invaded Georgia there in the Caucasus region and ended up prying a couple of states away from Georgia, which to this day are almost de facto Russian territory. Officially, they're part of Georgia. They call themselves autonomous, but for all real practical purposes, they might as well be states of Russia. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 2013, or 14 rather, and going on till this day, has been all the destabilization there in Ukraine, which is a bit of a buffer between Russia and Europe. So that has been particularly alarming to the Europeans, just as they've seen Russia pry the Crimean Peninsula away and continue to destabilize the eastern parts of Ukraine. But really, all the way since back in 2004, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been writing about the fact that this is frightening Europe, and it is hastening Europe's own efforts to become more militarily powerful and to lay the groundwork in order to be able to combine the military forces of the various European countries. He wrote an article in the January 2004 Trumpet. It's called "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy." And in this article, he said, "Europe's becoming very nervous about the outcome of the Russian election gives us a flash of light into a terrifying Bible prophecy. It is building now at this moment to a spectacular fulfillment. All of these events in Russia and Europe are working out according to God's master plan." And then from there, Mr. Fleury points to a Bible passage in Daniel 11 that shows that it was, you know, it was prophesied that Europe would become troubled or very frightened by hearing news about Russia's increasing military power and military, you know, machinations and maneuvers. And it's very clear that in the 13 years since Mr. Fleury wrote that article, Europe's fear of Russia has been a contributing factor to the European nations boosting their military might and laying the groundwork to be able to pool their armies together. And we have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that includes a chapter based on that article, that 2004 article by Mr. Fleury. And this chapter goes through a lot of this history about the dynamic that we've seen between Russia and Europe over the last decade or so. And it's very powerful. It's all based on specific Bible prophecies. And this booklet just does an excellent job of piecing it all together in a way that's really irrefutable. So I would just really encourage the listeners to go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy of Russia and China in Prophecy.
Just before we move on, I wondered, Richard, just because this, what we're talking about impacts your region, Europe, so much, if you had any comments looking at this from your perspective.
A lot of people from Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the Baltics, and Poland are very worried about this. And as he said, I think a lot of commentators are saying, well, in the past, Russia has used big military exercises as a cover for invasion. And people aren't necessarily expecting that this year, though I don't think anyone would rule it out entirely. But what they are worried about is they're saying, well, watch the weeks, the months after the military exercises and see, do they leave a considerable portion of troops in Belarus? Because the big focus in terms of strategy in Europe right now is that gap between Belarus and then Russian territory in Kaliningrad. That enclave on the Black Sea. And a lot of thinking goes around, can NATO hold this gap open? If Russia closes it, then the Baltics and Poland are, well, at least parts of Poland are cut off from NATO help. And so if Russia stations a whole load more troops in Belarus, it makes defending the Baltics much, much harder for Europe. And so that's kind of the focus of, or the fear that Russia is using this to move a substantial number of troops further west is going to be a longer term problem that probably won't diminish even after the exercises are over.
Well, we'll go ahead and move straight into our next story. Obviously, we're watching this development closely and the effect that it's having on Europe. The more aggressive Russia gets, the more that drives Europe to try to respond. And that's where we'll go for our next story. As I mentioned, another trend we keep our eye on, it's found on the trends page of our website, is Europe's ongoing unification project. You can find it there under the link, Europe becoming a 10-nation superpower. This is a long-standing forecast. It was first made by our predecessor, Herbert W. Armstrong. He talked about it for decades, really probably his number one prophecy regarding world news. And we've seen a lot of groundwork laid for the creation of this superpower. This week, the president of the European Commission gave a State of the Union address, and it vividly illustrated why we watch this trend so closely. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this was an excellent illustration of exactly that. The Telegraph yesterday in the UK, big newspaper there, it had in big letters right on the very front page, "A United States of Europe." Quite literally a headline that leaps off the pages of Bible prophecy and of what Herbert W. Armstrong has been writing for decades. He talked about how Europe wanted to create a United States of Europe And they used that term all the way back in 1954. So this is something he was writing about, forecasting for a long time. And so many things about that speech that Juncker gave and that that he wanted match exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong said, and things that we've written, things that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry have said over the years. So, for example, he talked about how they should be one captain of the European Union. You know, currently, they're in this situation where it's almost comical, where you've got 3 to 5 presidents, depending on how you count them. But he said, no, we need to make sure that we have one single president, which that's one of the big things we've talked about for a long time. Again, going back to that 1954 Plain Truth article, it said all Europe is just waiting for a confidence-inspiring leader. That's the kind of thing that Juncker is talking about. He talked about the European Union becoming a stronger global actor, being able to make foreign policy decisions more quickly, not getting bogged down in long negotiations or situations where one country can veto things. Of immediate practical significance, he talked about having a European Minister for Economy and Finance. And I think this could be in some ways even more significant if this moves ahead than his push for a European captain, because this is something that is backed by France and by Germany. He's calling for somebody who would be some kind of vice president and would have in charge of European economy and finance. This individual would be in charge also of the Eurozone and the Euro group, this very powerful meeting of European finance ministers. Kieran Underwood wrote an article for the Trumpet website. He dug out a great quote from that's attributed to the Rothschilds that says, "Give me control of a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws." And that's an excellent description of just the way this power traditionally works. If you control a nation's taxes, you control that nation. And so they're looking at creating that power. Then even just in some of the smaller details, it matches things that we've been saying for years. So, for example, talking about establishing a European cybersecurity agency. Obviously, like we've been talking about on defense, he talked about having a European defense system. He wanted a European defense union up and running by 2025. That's the European defense union. It's a nice way. People try to avoid the term European army because it has a lot of intellectual baggage. You can very easily see a European defense union referring to exactly the same thing. And then there's the standard global trade deals and things like that as well that he talked about creating.
Yeah, you know, Stephen Fleury has been talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and he's just focused on the comments that the UK's Nigel Farage has been making about this. And I think it was Farage who basically said this represents the religion of the Juncker and his ilk within the European Union, and they're trying to push ahead with this, just drawing attention to the fact that this flies completely in the face of Britain voting for Brexit, pulling out, that basically Europe is deciding we want to go ahead full steam ahead with this project, regardless of any kind of resistance that we may have among European populations. Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit, because when you look at this, the fact that he's making these pronouncements, these statements, it doesn't necessarily have a great deal of effect policy-wise, but it does show the ideological orientation of those at the heart of the European Union.
That's an excellent way of putting it. It is something that really shows their thinking. In some ways, Juncker gave the speech last year. They've been giving speeches like this for the last decade or two. Perhaps there are European officials that have talked about this even longer. But they keep giving these speeches, despite all of the things that come up, despite things like the euro crisis, despite things like Brexit, things that people have said and have thought that would make them stop and change their minds and consider if this is the right way. It doesn't change. And if anything, it gets stronger. And I think this speech was even stronger than last year's in terms of a lot of the specifics that it calls for, and especially that call for a single captain at the helm there. So, yeah, it does show their mindset. And in terms of how the ability of Juncker to actually make this kind of thing happen, I mean, in some way, maybe the best analogy for his powers would be maybe like, say, House Speaker in the US, though in some ways maybe even less so because he's dealing not with political parties but with sovereign nations. But on the other hand, certain parts of what he's calling for align very closely with the real powers in the European Union, Germany, and also to a lesser extent, France. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace had an article this week just talking about how you could really see European unity accelerating after the German election. And they talk about how Germany's actually wanted a lot more of these policies towards integration, things like a common Eurozone finance minister. But if they push for it, a lot of Europe is going to resist that, because just about all of Europe feels that Germany's got too much power as it is. And they were saying, well, now you've got Emmanuel Macron, who can kind of take point on pushing all of these things. Germany's quite happy for them to happen. And so after the election, it would just be kind of a case of Germany sitting back and supporting Macron and letting him take the lead. They talked about how Merkel has talked much more about Europe in this election campaign than in the past. And she's talked about having an economic finance minister, something that they wrote. Carnegie Europe wrote that this is a remarkable development in international government that could resonate for decades. So you could see, even with some of the groundwork being laid during the German election, for a lot of these things that Juncker's talking about.
You mentioned the article that we have up on thetrumpet.com by Kieran Underwood, Juncker's Vision for a United States of Europe. I'd really recommend that listeners go to that article and get more information about this. It also links to that trend, and I think this is a great opportunity to take a look at the trends page on thetrumpet.com, and we have this article there under the trend, Europe becoming a 10-nation superpower. The name of the article, Europe's Ongoing Unification Project. It really does give an in-depth look at why it is that we're watching this so closely, why it's important from a prophetic standpoint. Go on to thetrumpet.com and check that out. I think you'll find it very helpful. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're talking about how the rise of Russia is one pressure driving the European unification project forward. Another significant pressure is the migrant crisis that's been roiling for several years now. Migrants flowing in from crisis areas in the Middle East, some of which have been Muslim enemies of Europe. They've perpetrated terrorist acts there. It's creating a lot of consternation, a lot of anger and frustration among Europeans. It's also giving European governments reason to project their power into the Middle East. We've been following this story about Italy. They've been absorbing a lot of immigrants from Libya and trying to prevent that from happening. Well, people tracking the flow of migrants saw that last month there was a dramatic, sudden decrease in the number of immigrants making their way across the Mediterranean to Italy. To tell us why this happened and to put it in context for us, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's very interesting looking at what took place in August. It dumbfounded a lot of monitors and researchers as far as people that track the migration routes because of the absolutely stunning decrease to the point of 87% over what was taking place in August the previous year, this past August. So people were asking what happened, because there was a deal that has been worked out. We didn't really understand that deal and know of that deal until those August figures were released. And then people started researching into it and found out that there has been a very, I like to call it, shady deal that's taken place between Italy at the behest of the EU with Libya to shut down that migrant route. Now, before I talk about that more specifically, just for some context, there have been, as we know about, other migration routes through to Europe. The big one in 2015, that took place through Turkey. Over a million migrants came through there, mostly Middle Eastern, African men, and it worried Europe immensely as these migrants started settling in the different nations, and a lot of them heading towards Germany. And Europe tried in numerous ways to try and stop this, stop the migrants from coming. But basically, what stopped those migrants coming was a deal that Angela Merkel hammered out with Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. All these migrants were coming through Turkey, and so you have to go to the gatekeeper. In this case, it was the strongman Erdogan, and ask him or incentivize him to stop these migrants from coming in. That's what Angela Merkel did, to the tune of $3 to $6 billion. And then what happened soon thereafter, the flow of migrants stopped. And there was a 97% reduction from March 2016 from March 2015, once this deal was enacted. So basically, Erdogan was able to stop his border. Now, even going back before then, a similar deal was worked out in 2008 between Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and Muammar Gaddafi. Libya was sending, or migrants were coming from Libya, as they are now, into Italy. And what it looked like, there was about, I think, $6 or $5 billion that Italy gave to Gaddafi at the time and said, can you stop those migrants from coming? And Gaddafi was able to stop it. Now, in this case, we've had a similar thing take place, where Italy is paying off Libyans to stop migrants from heading to the boats to come into Libya. Now, this might sound as a good thing, and it is for the Italians and it is for the Europeans. But in Libya right now, we don't have a strongman. We don't have a Recep Tayyip Erdogan. We don't have a Muammar Gaddafi. What we have is a fractured state with tribal leaders all over the country that have taken part in this, the smuggling of migrants. They're actually the ones that have been perpetrating increasing the migrants, or being paid off by the migrants to ascend them to Italy. And what we've had since March this year is the Italian interior minister head down to Libya, and he's hosted numerous tribal officials from southern Libya all the way up until to the northern coast of Libya in Rome. And he's basically been paying them off to stop the migrant flows. And this came to a head in August when we saw, as I said before, an 87% drop in migration.
Okay, very volatile situation here. European dollars, Italian dollars pouring into Libya to some fairly shady actors. As you said, it's not just one guy at the top. These are various groups that are being bought off here. What are the dangers inherent in a deal like this?
Well, yeah, that's the issue that a lot of, especially human rights groups, are looking at right here. And even Libyans, they're looking at this from a different perspective. But just thinking about who's being paid off, again, not all of them, but many of these people and tribal leaders, they were the ones that were getting paid by the migrants. And now they're getting paid by Italy to not do what they were doing. So they've made it more beneficial for them, Italy has, at the behest of Europe. Europe's basically washing their hands of this. They have given free rein to the Interior Ministry of Italy and said, we want you to deal with it. And they gave, this is European money, not just Italian money. So Europe is complicit in this. But the Italians have gone down there and they've found out a way, I guess, of stopping the different migrant routes. Now, as you said, there are very, very real-term dangers, real-life dangers in this policy. Number one, you're going to have a lot of migrants now that are stuck in Libya, stuck in different camps that have been called even concentration camps, because there's no functioning government, remember, that the Italians are paying off. So who's running these camps? These camps are being run by the same people that are now charged with deporting these migrants from all over Africa. And they are the groups that don't really have a penchant for human rights. So you're going to have a drastic situation, and numerous human rights organizations are worried about this. Even the Europeans are kind of worried about this. They just had a meeting yesterday. All the interior ministers of the EU nations came together to discuss with the interior minister of Italy what the plan is, and all of them said, it's great. Look, the migrants have stopped. Yes, we're worried about the humanitarian concerns and how the migrants will be treated inside Libya, but at least they're not coming here.
Right.
And it's kind of dumbfounding to me to look at the European nations in this, and the European leaders, in the sense of being considered in many ways, they consider themselves morally superior to many other nations, and yet they are causing a humanitarian disaster outside their borders by doing this. Now, what is Europe meant to do? They don't have
no good answers.
Libya. Right. There are no good answers here. So I don't necessarily blame them for this, but there are going to be people that are stuck in what some are calling this buffer zone of Europe. They're going to be migrants stuck there that are going to be looked after before they're deported by some very unsavory characters. So there's that. There's also the worry amongst Libyans themselves that you're going to have Italian dollars or European dollars that are directly funding militia leaders, tribal leaders inside Libya that is going to give quite a lot of power to the Europeans. There are some towns in Libya where over half of their budget has been funded by people smuggling, by funding the migrant game. And now that's been replaced by the Italian government and who they deem they think can stop the migrants from coming in. So there's great sovereignty issues here that are at play, where there are a number of Libyans that are worried that this is going to give lots more power to Europe to direct affairs inside Libya. Even that quote that Richard was saying, Richard talked about earlier, who controls the money? It doesn't matter about the government. And now you have this injection of cash from Europe inside Libya that could only increase Europe's power inside Libya.
Very quickly, Brent, put it in prophetic context for us. And if people could, if you want to send people to somewhere to get more information.
Yeah, well, I've just written a piece up on the Trump.com. I think it'll be up early next week. It's entitled Europe's Shady Migrant Deal with Libya. And towards the end of that, I talk about Libya being a flashpoint between Europe and the Islamic power, particularly led by Iran. That is what the Bible says in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 to 43. You are going to have a clash between Europe and radical Islam led by Iran. And one of those flashpoints is Libya. And while we don't necessarily see the Iranian element right now in Libya, you have a lot of Islamist groups that are still active inside Libya that see what Europe is doing, that do not agree with the UN-backed government that is supporting what Europe's doing, and they do not like Europe's encroachment into their territory. So those groups are going to be further agitated by these moves. So again, Bible prophecy looks at this area of Libya as being this flashpoint very soon in biblical prophecy that leads to a whole lot of others. You can read that article I've written, or you can get the backstory for this particular Mediterranean hotspot by reading Gerald Flory's article, Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III.
Excellent stuff, Brent. Thanks very much. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about terrorism in London. Happened this morning. The environmental disasters in the United States you didn't hear about because of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. The real meaning behind sanctions against North Korea. How Hezbollah's budget has quadrupled since the nuclear deal with Iran went into effect. And opioid addiction has quadrupled just since 2000 in the United States. Those stories and more coming up after the break.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Just this morning, terror once again struck London. A homemade bomb going off in a packed rush hour commuter train. For this story, we're going to go to Andrew Miller.
And this was actually the fifth major terrorist attack England has suffered this year. As you said, like about 8:20 this morning, London time, they had a homemade bomb going off in a crowded subway. 22 people injured, sent to the hospital. Doesn't look like there'll be any deaths. The bomb didn't completely detonate, but it is definitely... a lot of injuries. They haven't really announced anything on who did the attack. They don't have a suspect as of now. But there was a one anonymous source within the U.S. government just pointing out that the Islamic State recently released a video encouraging people in England to make bombs and set them off in subways. And so there's a strong connection that that could have been someone taking them up on their advice there. And there has been some Islamic State praise for the act. They haven't claimed responsibility for it, but they've said that definitely this just show how vulnerable British security is, and praise the actions of the person who set the bomb.
Remarkable. Five incidents of terror in Britain so far this year. We just continue to see that besieging that country. In the meantime, curses befalling the United States. The dramatic hurricanes that besieged Texas and then Florida in the last couple of weeks in the southeast U.S. garnered a lot of news coverage in America, but there were other environmental disasters happening elsewhere in the country at the same time. They would have gotten a lot more coverage if they hadn't been upstaged by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. We'll look at these now, going back to Andrew.
Yeah, this was definitely a topic we probably would have talked about last week or the week before on this program if it wasn't for just these two massive hurricanes that have hit the United States this month. There are actually currently 123 large wildfires burning in the United States. They're consuming about 2 million acres of land spread across 9 states. Many of them the worst ever. The city of Los Angeles had its worst wildfire ever. Montana is fighting its worst fire season in at least 20 years since the 90s. They said the United States Forest Service has spent almost $2 billion fighting these fires, which somewhat pales in significance compared to the almost $200 billion in damage done by these two hurricanes. But it is that the $1.75 billion they've spent fighting these fires so far is pretty much enough to let the Forest Service burn through their wildfire fighting budget already this year. Mm-hmm. And so now they're asking that if the government passes any relief programs for these hurricanes to try to put an amendment at the end of it, giving them more money to keep up with these fires that are just consuming large parts of the United States.
So why do we watch these events so closely? Why is it important that we keep abreast of this?
Right. Well, for the past couple weeks in relation to the hurricanes, we've just really advertised our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, which just really does go through all the way back to the Garden of Eden of like why there are natural disasters in the first place and the prophecies about natural disasters that are coming as a punishment for sin. One particular verse we used comes to mind, especially in relation to these wildfires, is in Isaiah 29 and verse 6, where this is the prophet Isaiah writing to Israel about their sins, and it says, "You shall be visited by the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and with great noise, with storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire," which is, and that's all packed into one verse, which just really does describe basically the last 2 weeks of news in the United States, with storm and with tempest and with devouring fire, to where you've got Houston, 50 counties in Texas devastated by a storm, all of southern Florida devastated by a storm, and 2 million acres of land devoured by a consuming fire.
Yeah, well, if you're interested, go on to thetrumpet.com, and under the literature tab, you can find that booklet, Why Natural Disasters. Definitely puts all of this in context. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We'll turn now to another story out of Asia. North Korea has been making some extremely provocative actions lately, firing a thermonuclear bomb, firing missiles over Japan. On Monday, the UN Security Council voted for more sanctions on North Korea. It sounds like a victory for the U.S.-led efforts to neutralize this threat. But when you look into the details, it isn't quite what it seems. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, that's right. This was actually the hardest-hitting sanctions that the United Nations has put in place over North Korea. They voted unanimously on September 11th to put this package in place, and America really has sort of tried to just portray it as a victory for the U.S.-led efforts to reduce that threat. But as you said, if you look below the surface even just a little bit, it's very clear that the UN's move here actually showcases the influence not of America, but of Russia and China. And it really shows that Moscow and Beijing are the ones who hold the cards on North Korea. So initially, the Trump administration had proposed a UN resolution that included a total ban on exporting oil to the North. It also called for a freeze on the assets of the North Korean government and its leader, Kim Jong-un. It called for a total ban on importing North Korean textiles and an injunction on hiring and paying North Korean slave laborers who work in other countries to earn cash for the regime. And it included a global travel ban on Kim Jong-un and several others in his government. So the U.S.'s original proposal was quite severe, at least as far as sanctions go. And if the nations of the world would have approved all of those measures and adhered to them, especially cutting off all oil exports to North Korea, it really would have had a deep impact on North Korea's economy. And it could have eventually even applied sufficient pressure to bring about some sort of a change in the status quo. But that was not the resolution that the UN Security Council ended up approving. Russia and China are both permanent members on the UN Security Council, and that means they both have the power to veto any resolution that they don't like. And both of them were opposed to the idea of a total oil embargo on North Korea. And so they made clear that they would not approve the U.S.'s original draft resolution. On the day that the U.S. proposed that original resolution, Russian President Vladimir Putin said, quote, "We should not give in to emotions and push Pyongyang into a corner," end quote. And so the U.S. knows that it's not even worth bringing a resolution to the table if it's something that Russia or China or any other nation with veto power won't approve of. Right. So the American leadership set to work watering it down. And they set to work weakening it to a degree that would make it acceptable to Moscow and Beijing. And the result was Resolution 2375. That's what was approved of on September 11th. And Russia and China allowed it to pass because it does not push Pyongyang into a corner, as Putin said there. Rather than banning oil exports to North Korea, it only caps them at current levels. And then the punitive measures against Kim Jong-un were also cut out. So the resolution that passed is very unlikely to make much of a difference at all. It won't make any real impact on the economy. There's a South Korean lawmaker named Lee Soo-hyuk, and she said, quote, "If there's a total embargo, that would be a good step, but setting a cap on crude oil exports to North Korea is meaningless." Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. You know, the U.S. can try to portray this new sanctions package as a victory, but thanks to Russia and China, it is ultimately meaningless, and it allows Kim Jong-un to keep on building nuclear weapons and missiles, and it allows the North Korean threat to keep on growing. And I think this development is really interesting because it followed immediately on the heels of some statements that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry made on September 2nd. On September 2nd, he basically said, "It is Russia and China that the world should be concerned about far more than North Korea."
Right.
"Because it is those two nations who allow North Korea to operate so freely." So that was September 2nd that Mr. Flurry said that. And then the very next day, North Korea detonated its first hydrogen bomb. And that's really what prompted the U.S. to push for that original resolution that would have reined North Korea in, or at least attempted to. And then within a few days after that is when Russia and China kind of shadow vetoed that original resolution and replaced it with one that's meaningless. Mm-hmm. So these events all happened right after Mr. Flurry made those statements about Russia and China, and they really proved that his analysis was entirely accurate. And really that should come as no surprise to readers of the Trumpet magazine or longtime listeners of the Trumpet Hour, because Mr. Flurry's forecasts are based on the sure word of Bible prophecy. And It's the Bible that says Russia and China will be the ones that lead an astoundingly powerful military bloc in the end time. And it is Bible prophecy that shows that North Korea will not be a major player in end-time conflicts. The scriptures show that nations like North Korea will be assimilated into that Russia-led bloc,
right,
and lend their military power to it, but they will not be the main players or the leaders of it.
And you can definitely see how China and Russia, particularly China, are using North Korea to their advantage to secure their own ambitions very, very effectively. There's just so much attention that's going toward North Korea, but yeah, absolutely. The real power player here is China, and this resolution in the UN definitely shows that very forcibly. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. When the Obama administration negotiated the Iran nuclear deal, the president touted that deal suppressing Iran's nuclear development capability, although there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. But his staff actually admitted that the money that would go to Iran from that deal could be directed to Iran underwriting terrorist activities. Well, they were right. And more evidence of that fact emerged this week. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So it seems like every week we have spoken about the growing threat that Hezbollah boasts against Israel in the north of Israel and also in Syria. Well, we've been talking about that threat as it has been financed from Iran or by Iran. Hezbollah is from the past decade or so. And for the past few years, they've been doing that on a budget of about $200 million a year. Sounds like quite a lot of money, and indeed it is, considering this took place. They received that much money during the sanction era when Iran didn't have access to global markets, could not sell a lot of its oil on the open market as well. And yet it deemed that Hezbollah should get $200 million. And during that time, Hezbollah has developed a huge arsenal of missiles that are focused on Israel. They've been able to enter the Syrian civil war and fight there with about 7,000 fighters. But it turns out, according to the Jerusalem Post today, that Hezbollah is going to get an increased budget. From $200 million a year, it is going to receive up to $800 million a year of financial aid from Iran. That's a 400% increase. So, and this is, and it's been framed at least by the Jerusalem Post, in the wake, as you said, of the nuclear deal, which opened Iran up to nuclear, up to the international markets, opened up its oil to the world. It also released about $100 billion of frozen assets as well, cash of frozen assets. And what are they putting that money towards? Well, they are definitely putting it towards their sponsorship of Hezbollah in a dramatic, dramatic way.
Well, this really underlines what we've been talking about the last few weeks, of just how much Iran's activity and the pressure that they're putting on Israel is increasing. You've talked a lot about just how much the theater in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah and even Iran's presence there on Israel's northern border is really making Israel nervous. Israel undertook these war games recently to shot down the Syrian chemical weapons facility just a week ago. So putting this in context, it really does show yet more evidence of how determined Iran seems to be to bear down on Israel.
Yeah, and I mean that you could think about the different arenas where Iran would spend its money and could spend its money. Internally, Iran is still suffering with a lot of its money not being put back into its own country. A lot of it, billions of dollars worth, is going towards its missile production program, ballistic missile production program. It's going towards what it does in Yemen. We just talked about last week or the week before how they have increased their funding with Hamas. That's back on the right schedule as well. And now Hezbollah is going to receive eight. I don't know. What are they going to do with that much
money?
Yeah. A lot of money. That's a huge budget for the development of weaponry to be used against Israel and even funding more fighters. They have to this day, I think, about 22,000 fighters. Hezbollah does. That's a sizable army. 7,000, as I said, of those are fighting for the Assad regime. Some 2,000 have been killed in the past few years over there. But think of the recruits, think of the mercenaries that could be paid and bought off with this money as well, especially as you're going to have, as it looks like the Syrian civil war dies down, a lot of fighters that are going to be willing to be bought out. You think of the huge tens of thousands of Afghani soldiers that are now fighting for Iran in Syria right now. What are they going to do? Well, Hezbollah's got a lot of money from Iran. So you could see the just inflation of Hezbollah's troop numbers because of this cash and because of the available mercenaries that are going to be at Iran's disposal.
It just makes me wonder, what sort of repercussions would Iran face from this? How many international players are looking at this and saying, wow, we made a mistake, we need to rethink this, we need to put more pressure on Iran? When stories like this come out, it just seems like so often that's end of story and there are no follow-on effects, and Iran doesn't face any repercussions for this.
Yeah, it seems like until you are the nation that is affected by it, the world is as it is governed by self-interest, and it just doesn't act in general. Israel has faced the brunt of it. Israel will continue to face the brunt of it. Israel will continue to act alone if it has to. But as we know, Iran's goals, they do extend past Israel as well. And $800 million is going towards Hezbollah. But a lot of its cash is going towards its ballistic missile program as well, and it doesn't need ballistic missiles to hit Israel.
Just to quickly wrap up, Brent, to bring the listener up to speed who hasn't been following this story along with us these last few weeks, if somebody wants more information and putting this in prophetic context, where would you send them?
Well, there's a couple of things that I would do. I would first read this article by our editor-in-chief from April 2016. It's entitled The Worst Foreign Policy Blunder in American History, and we'll have this link for you in the show notes. And you can click on that and read that and just look at what we said was going to happen as the result of this nuclear deal. And we talked about the world not becoming a safer place because of this. And we talked about it funding the proxies of Iran as well. And that's what we're seeing. So you can look at that. And then, of course, you can go to Jerusalem and Prophecy, a booklet that really does show Iran's goals at destabilizing and attacking Israel for its own benefit. So that one was Jerusalem and Prophecy.
Thanks for that, Brent. We have time to squeeze in one more short story here. America has a huge opioid addiction problem, and it's getting worse. Recent statistics show just how much worse. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is the one of the biggest, if not the biggest, drug problems the United States has faced. It's getting to the point where, millions of people are addicted to opioid painkillers. There are even babies being born addicted to opioids because their mothers were addicted to the drug during pregnancy. The use for opioids has quadrupled since the year 2000, and the death rate is now up to about 600 people a week, which just by contacts, that's about four times as many people as were dying a week during the worst days of the Vietnam War, about two times as many people as are dying a week from murders in the United States, and roughly the same amount of people who die in car crashes each week.
That's terrible.
This is something where a lot of it started out with people, just doctors over-prescribing painkillers, and now the government's trying to crack down on it. But if we just crack down cold turkey, like a lot of states are doing, people are just turning to heroin as the alternative because it's actually cheaper and not as effective as opioids are, but it is the same molecule.
So if people wanted more information on this, where would be a good place to send them to, Andrew?
Probably our booklet, No Freedom Without Law, just really spends quite a bit of time on just that. The slavery that drug addiction puts people through going in there. This is actually something that, even though a lot of people don't know it, is really addressed quite a bit in the Bible. One of the works of the flesh in Galatians 5:20 is witchcraft, which is translated from a Greek word, pharmakeia, which literally means drug addiction. In ancient Greece, it was common to actually take opium when you went to the temple to have a hallucinogenic religious experience, which is what the Apostle Paul was condemning primarily in this verse. So, I mean, it is really telling in the way that it's actually even the same drug, opium. The opium is what they use to make opioids, and even though people sometimes use it for different reasons, there are some people who are still looking for that hallucinogenic experience, which is something that the Bible, or at least the King James translators of the Bible, called witchcraft, and something that was with us a huge sin in the ancient world and still a really major sin in America today.
Well, that is going to do it for our program today. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we'd like you to visit thetrumpet.com. You can find a lot of the stories that we talked about on the program there, expounded on in much greater detail on the website there, as well as the literature that we spoke about. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to these gentlemen who've helped me out today, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice of you to have me on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Arthur Schopenhauer: talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.